there's operatives from Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, but we don't deal with Pakistan. We don't mind these dictatorial governments as long as they're pro-United States.
Entertaining the idea of someone like Ahmed Chalabi to rule Iraq, they would take a thief of an honest religious clergyman.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, April 29th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Today, a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, Secretary of State Colin Powell responded to concerns California Democrat Senator Barbara Boxer was about the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. White House and Pentagon officials base much of their case for a military invasion of Iraq on the unproven pretext that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. But as a military operation winds down, the failure of the U.S. and British forces to find any weapons has caused considerable embarrassment for the Bush administration in the court of world public opinion.
Do you feel that our people who are searching for these weapons are the very best qualified in the world to do this? And do you think we'll get more results when some of these Iraqis that we are capturing now on the list, when we have these people speaking, we will be led to these weapons?
On the question of weapons of mass destruction, they will be found. The presentation I made before the United Nations on 5th of February was at the end of four straight days of living with the entire intelligence community and going over every single thing we knew. Every day and every night leading up to the 5th of February, I was closeted with our very best experts. Everything we had there had backup and double sourcing and triple sourcing. 1441 really was the key. A key element in this conflict, in the sense that it not only gave legitimacy to what we did, but it brought the council together 15-0 to say that Iraq is guilty and it is condemnable. And if they don't fix themselves, they are subject to serious consequences. I agree with you, or let me pick up what you said about interviews. We will learn more, and we're learning more right now. I'm getting almost daily reports, so little nuggets that are coming out with respect to what was done, what might have been destroyed in recent days, where certain records are. So I'm confident that we'll be able to deal with that.
Secretary of State Colin Powell responding to questions at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today. U.S. soldiers killed at least 13 Iraqi civilians who marched on a school west of Baghdad to demand the troops leave the building and get out of Iraq. That's according to doctors and witnesses quoted by Reuters News Service. Medics said 75 people were also wounded in the march by more than 200 protesters on the school after Muslim prayers on Monday evening in Fallujah, 30 miles from the Iraqi capital. Some witnesses put the death toll as high as 17. Residents said the marchers were unarmed. U.S. forces said the troops opened fire only after they were shot at by a group of gunmen armed with AK-47 assault rifles. Peace Watch caught up with Nada Duhamani earlier today. She's the spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Baghdad. In part one of a two-part conversation, Duhamani gives an account of the killings in Fallujah and conditions in Baghdad at this time.
We have one of our colleagues who lived in Fallujah, in fact, and who told us that yesterday the situation was very tense in the city. And in the evening, there was an anti-U.S. demonstration in some streets of Fallujah. And apparently, some people shot at the U.S. forces who were patrolling in the city without injuring anybody, according to our reports. But the U.S. military fired back, and 13 people have been killed, while 55 people who were injured and taken to the General Hospital of Fallujah. Today, we went again to Fallujah with some medical and surgical item equipment necessary for the hospital, which was overloaded with the injured people. And apparently, two of those injured passed away.
So who exactly did you get your report from, your information? Was it a member of your team?
One of our colleagues who lives in Fallujah, an Iraqi colleague who lives in Fallujah, a trustful person. And he came and told us the story that this morning we went there with some medical and surgical equipment to bring it to the hospital, and we took some testimonies from people there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so is it unusual, do you think, that we're hearing various reports, and some were that a group of individuals ranging in age from 5 to 20 were actually fired upon by the U.S. troops after someone from that group apparently threw stones at the facility where the troops were. What can you tell us about that? That's a report that we're hearing from the Associated Press.
Yes, well, this is your report, and I've heard it too, but we can only rely on our report, and this is what I've already told you, that there was this demonstration, and some people, we don't know whom, fired at the U.S. troops, and the U.S. troops fired back on the demonstrators and killed some of them, as I just mentioned.
So what can you tell us about the people that were killed? Do you know anything about their ages or whether this might have been politically inspired?
Well, I am not sure. I mean, I think they are adults, and I don't know about their political affiliation. Fallujah is a very conservative city. There are two main tribes in the city, and I think before this demonstration took place, the situation was already tense for internal reasons, for a tribal feud between two groups.
All of this took place at an anti-U.S. demonstration. Are those fairly common there? And what can you tell us about the size of that demonstration?
Well, regularly in Baghdad, you know, there are demonstrations, anti-U.S. demonstrations, some of them what they call them anti-occupying forces. I must say that most of them are quite peaceful, if they go out in a peaceful way. I mean, then there's no violence generally. They usually demonstrate in front of the Palestine Hotel, of the Meridian Hotel, where all journalists are there. And we've heard that yesterday there was a huge demonstration also, but that was linked to the meeting which was held by the previous Iraqi opposition with the presence of Jevon J. Garner.
Nada, how would you summarize how the International Committee of the Red Cross is able to function there in Baghdad on this day as a result of the invasion?
Well, we have been working in Iraq always in very difficult conditions. We were here also during the Gulf War in 1991. So we are used to work in difficult conditions. What I would like now to stress is that the need to have a civil administration, that we can have interlocutors, that we can have things running. I think the problem now we're facing is some kind of a chaotic organization at the level of the civil administration. We really need to have it back in place. Our concern is that basic needs of the population are met, and so far we cannot say that they are covered. There is not a real shortage of food, if we take this example, but people don't have the means to buy the food. Most shops are still closed, and even if the shops open, I mean, people haven't had any economy. The economy is down, the economy has collapsed, so people don't have the means to buy anything. They are not working, or they have been kicked out of their job, or nothing is really working properly. The normal life has to come back.
Can you describe the quality or the routine of a life for an Iraqi,
you know,
at this point?
Minimal. I would say it's the minimal that's functioning for the time being. You know, schools are still closed. Most shops are still closed. The electricity is not on all the time. In the evening, it's quite unsecure, still unsecure. You hear a lot of shooting in the evening. In any case, there is a curfew in the night, which is also a good measure if you want to install security. All public services, of course, as I just mentioned, there are, of course, no public services running. Now everybody seems to be concerned about, there are a lot of protection issues that are at stake now. We have a lot of vulnerable groups now coming in need of protection. A lot of people like Palestinians, Syrians who have been here living before and now feel that they are threatened. We have also some different problems with issue of missing. We have hundreds of people coming every day to our office, to the International Red Cross office. Either they want to make phone calls abroad because there are no telecommunications in Iraq. Now we're talking because we are privileged and we do have a cell phone at the International Red Cross, but nobody has any phone. No phones are working in Iraq for the time being, not internal nor external. So we have people coming who would like to speak with their relatives abroad, who would like to have news about other relatives inside the country. Everybody seems to be looking for somebody. Some people don't know whether their relatives are detained, whether in the camp, which is in the south, or somewhere else here, or whether they have been killed during this war. And now we hear a lot of stories about mass graves being uncovered from recent ones, or from dating from 10 years or from 20 years back. So it's really very confused situation.
Mass graves are being uncovered for what reason?
Well, people are digging now and are recovering bodies. Some date back from 10 years, 20 years. Some recent mass graves from these from this last war, people have been buried probably very hastily. And now we are facing a new problem, the problem of the missing and the families looking for their missing relatives. And it's very difficult to trace back all these people. Some people have been buried without any marking, without any way to identify the corpses, and we'll be left with this problem for years. We have had this experience already in the Balkans. It's still on now with people missing from previous wars.
So you're saying,
you know, also from the Iran-Iraqi war, there are still 70,000 people missing from the Iran-Iraqi war. And now that with all the changes that happened in this country, people are probably coming back with plenty of stories.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying that there in Baghdad now, people are unearthing recently hastily dug graves to try and identify
yes.
their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
To see if their
mm-hmm.
loved ones are buried there. Does that go on quite regularly,
yes.
or is that a rare occurrence?
Well, we've heard about some cases like this. Some reports talk about graves, people being buried during the latest battle that took place near the airport, and apparently there have been many casualties. We didn't check that ourselves. Tomorrow we'll go to some place, to Abu Ghraib, which was the main prison in Baghdad, in order to recover some of the bodies which have been buried here. We don't know from when, if they are recent, if they are old ones. We try to find out if we can.
Okay. Nada, any final thoughts on your part?
No, I really think this issue of all the people missing and the people in need of protection, there are a lot of people who are being detained now by the coalition forces. And we would like at the International Red Cross to be notified of this arrest, to be able to get access and to meet these people. And this will also help the families who have no clue where their relatives have gone. And I think it's important that according to the Geneva Convention, we do have access to all people detained. As you know, we consider this legally as a state of occupation, and we are entitled as International Red Cross to have access to these people, whether they are civilian internees or whether they are considered as prisoners of war, to all people detained, including what they call the VIPs. They have been detained now.
Do you have access to those people now? Has the military told you that you cannot?
No, not at all. We are asking for access. Not at all. We would like to get access to all the people detained. And I mean, we have also had allegations of threats from different people are coming to the office saying some of their relatives have been arrested. They don't know where they've been taken. And I think it's very urgent that we can be notified so that the families know where to look for their relatives.
Hmm. And what does the military tell you as a member of the International Red Cross when you ask them about having access to these detainees?
Well, we have asked to get access, and I think the coalition forces know very well that we should be granted this access. We have reminded them already before this war started, all the parties in the conflict at the time, there was also the Iraqi authorities, the British and the Americans, that it's part of their obligations according to the Geneva Conventions to give us access to visit detainees, and we are waiting.
Nada Doumani, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, speaking with us earlier today from Baghdad.
The missiles, they fly, and the bombs keep on falling. You city is crumbling, you're all terrified. Pack everyone in, make a dash for the border. 15 in your family, you ran for your lives. Your father's own father, he fought the invaders. Your father, he welcomes them, dressed to the nines. Your brothers and sisters and babies are with you. They rode that truck until most of them died. Goodbye to this family shot down by our soldiers. Those who 1,000 cruise missiles roll over. You won't have a name when you're killed by our airplanes. All they will call you is dead Iraqis.
As Iraqis rejoice at the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime while protesting the U.S. military occupation of their country, Peace Watch decided to check in today with Abbas Kadim. Kadim is an Iraqi-American originally from the city of Najaf who joined in the uprising against Saddam Hussein following the 1991 Gulf War. After the U.S. failed to back the Iraqi resistance, Kadim went to Saudi Arabia, where he was detained in a camp for over a year. He's now teaching at the University of California at Berkeley and finishing a doctorate in Islamic studies. Peace Watch spoke with him from his home today to get his reactions to the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the plans for an interim government possibly headed by Ahmed Chalabi.
Watching the regime fall from the United States, not being in Iraq, it was a special feeling, but it was a relief to see that an era of oppression is gone. Also mixed with a lot of sorrow that it didn't happen 13 years ago when we tried to do it. Iraq and the rest of the world lived with the regime for all of these years unnecessarily. It could have been done the first time around. But there is a sense of relief that finally, you know, the world will not be living with this dictator.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Kadim, you were part of the Iraqi opposition following the first Gulf War. Now that Saddam Hussein has been removed from power, what role do you think the U.S. should actually play?
At this point?
Yes.
Well, the United States, you know, can really take great credit for what happened to Iraq. And the removal of the dictator, although it is happening almost too late and it's an overdue thing to do. And remember, the United States had a major role in the making and the sustainment of Saddam Hussein and the support of Saddam Hussein through the 80s and also made the horrible mistake of not allowing the Iraqis to remove him in 1991. So this is not just a gift that is given to the Iraqi people. I think it's fixing a past mistake or a number of past mistakes. But nevertheless, I mean, this is the Iraqi people. I don't think they have anything against the United States. That is not changeable, no sentiments that are fixed forever. If they will really put words to action and do exactly as what they say in their speeches, the American politicians will probably come across as some wonderful people. But if they keep doing what is being done right now, delaying any process that is going to make Iraqi people live better, insisting on a government of their own choosing, insisting on hand-picked people who can go to the meetings and participate, insisting on this contempt and ignoring of the Iraqi demonstrations and the voice of the Iraqis, I think they are probably to expect uneasy times in Iraq, because the Iraqis are not going to allow this kind of behavior to pass without any trouble. And I hope that the first scenario will prevail.
Well, Well, what about Ahmed Chalabi and Generals Tommy Franks and Jay Garner? Do they, in your opinion, is there a credible, valuable role that they can play in this process at this time?
Well, Ahmed Chalabi, again, has no room to be in Iraq. I mean, if there is one place that is suitable for him is a Jordanian jail where he spent his 22-year sentence. There. Remember, he's escaping from Jordan after he was sentenced, or actually before he was sentenced. He was sentenced in absentia in Jordan for 22 years for embezzlement. I think this is one of the things that will give the United States a very bad image, insisting or at least entertaining the idea of someone like Ahmed Chalabi to rule Iraq. Meanwhile, they absolutely shut the door before some honest religious figures, for example. You know, they would take a thief over an honest religious clergyman. This will not sit well with Iraqis. Mm-hmm. As far as Garner, I mean, he has no authority whatsoever there. But if he sticks to what he is doing, simply rebuilding Iraq, I don't think the Iraqis will be bothered by his presence, so long as he doesn't interfere with the choice of Iraqis of who will govern them, and he seems to be doing so all along. He is not. I haven't seen any reports on him doing any restoration of normalcy into the Iraqi life. All he's doing is attending all of these meetings that are political in nature, while the capital is still without many of the basics of life, like electricity and fresh water. Tom Franks, again, he's a man who accomplished in a military mission, and I think his next role probably is to keep order, which is the responsibility of any occupying force, until a government is on its feet. And again, there is nothing really against these people, so long as they do things in a very legitimate way. And the best way to do it is not really to make it a 100% United States-sponsored process, because this will give any government the stigma of being an agent of the West and an agent of imperialism and the United States. And again, the people there will not accept it and will not act towards such government as a legitimate government, and it will lose authority even if they have the best intentions for the mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. The members of such a government will never be trusted. So I think whether or not the intentions there are to make a government in Iraq that is working closely with the West or serving the American interests, even if the intentions are not exactly that, I think the appearance will be that it is one that does exactly the service or complete service to American interests, and the people there will not be ready to cooperate with such government.
Abbas Qadim, an Iraqi-American originally from Najaf, Iraq, and a teacher at the University of California at Berkeley. The debate over regime change rages among Iraqis. But according to Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, more than 150 Iraqis living in the U.S. volunteered to return to their native country to create a democratic government. And the Pentagon sent a delegation of Iraqi exiles from the U.S. to serve under retired General Jay Garner as he establishes the interim Iraqi authority. At the same time, however, federal authorities also have increased their activities against Iraqi Americans. The FBI recently interviewed 300 Iraqi immigrants to gather intelligence about the possibility of retaliatory terrorist attacks in the U.S. The Bush administration used the terrorism attacks of September 11, 2001, as justification for invading Iraq, although a clear link between the Saddam Hussein regime and al-Qaeda has never been established. Recently, Peace Watch spoke with two men who suffered great losses on September 11th. Stephen Push and Bob McElvain expressed their thoughts on the current political situation in Iraq.
I feel like I'm being slapped in the face every day of my life. And it's just like if you had a son or a relative murdered, that's the first thing you want to find out is why did this happen? And it just seems like it's being ignored. Since we use September 11th as a, you know, using the emotion of September 11th as a pretext to go to war, and with the information out there, it's just there's no reason for it. I mean, it truly makes me depressed. It makes me sad. But it's just I want to get my word out. What has happened? Why has this happened? And we do not want this war. And the information, it's mind-boggling that approximately 43% of the people in the United States believe that Saddam Hussein had direct contact with 9/11, which, you know, is just a bold-faced lie. So it's a matter of information. It's a matter of knowledge. You know, people finding out what has happened, and it just seems so difficult to get this message out. Even in my neighborhood, even in my support group in Philadelphia, it's like a 50-50 split.
Stephen, your wife, Lisa Raines, was killed on American Airlines Flight 77 on September 11th, 2001. What are your thoughts now?
Personally, I support the war effort. I don't think we're going to see an end to international terrorism or to Islamic fundamentalism until democracy has an opportunity to flourish in the Middle East countries. I think that we have to give the Iraqi people an opportunity. We can't create democracy for them. They have to do that for themselves.
Peaceful tomorrows, everyone in peaceful tomorrows is against the war and, you know, have campaigned against it. You know, as I said, I have a support group in Philadelphia that I go to every week, and you could say it's 50-50. But Peaceful Tomorrows has approximately 70 members, 50 of which are September 11th families, brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. And I was against Afghanistan from the very beginning. I just thought after my son's death, I'm trying to, you know, I need meaning from this, you know, it's just like, it can't go to waste. And I just think the direction we're going is absolutely wrong. I thought that right after September 11th, I thought it was a real nice window of opportunity that, geez, everyone is against this act. There wasn't a person in the world that wasn't against this act, except, of course, the terrorists. And to me, it was a perfect opportunity to the world to unite. Let's do it as a United Nations group. Find these terrorists. Let's bring them to justice. To me, that's what it's all about. And I think we blew the opportunity. And it's just we've alienated the rest of the world. I think terrorism will get worse. And we go into Syria. It's just it seems like a never-ending struggle now. And to me, it's defeating the purpose. And I just think we blew it.
I think in the press, very often, too much emphasis is put on a single man. If it wasn't bin Laden, it would be someone else. There are other leaders who would take his place. I think if we're going to be effective, we have to first dismantle the known terrorist groups and cells that exist, and then change the conditions that gave rise to the terrorists. And as I said earlier, I think the only thing that's going to change the conditions is a change in Middle East societies that give people an opportunity for a good life. If they had better opportunities, then people like Osama bin Laden would not be able to get very many recruits.
Well, you know, again, I hate to get historical, but, you know, since the fall of the Ottoman Empire at the turn of the century, you know, that's the problem. We've never given anyone the opportunity to practice democracy. I mean, 15 out of the 19 people came from Saudi Arabia, but of course no one mentions that. The Pakistanian, which are supposedly our allies, their secret police have been dealing with Al-Qaeda since, you know, Al-Qaeda was formed until this day. I mean, there's operatives from Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, but we don't deal with Pakistan. We don't mind these dictatorial governments as long as they're pro-United States. And, of course, through the 80s, we supplied Hussein with all these, you know, weapons of mass destruction. Of course we knew what we had because we had all the receipts from it. So, I mean... we're absolutely right that we want to sort of spread democracy in here, but we got to give these people a chance to evolve into it. And that's where public policy is. Our foreign policy has to change.
Bob McElvain and Stephen Push, who both lost family members on September 11th. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Without your financial support, Peace Watch will cease to exist as of May 1st. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. We urge you to make your pledge of support through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'll be back in a moment.